I'm Bob Jagenich, a director of Decision Diagnostics, board of directors member, more precisely.
I'm Keith Berman, also a director of Decision Diagnostics. Okay. Bob, it's kind of traditional when we've had these things that you've make a couple of statements to start it, and then I'll make a couple of statements, and then we'll open.
Can we talk louder, please?
We're doing the best we can. So, Bob, why
not
don't
good
you,
enough.
You, I'm sorry.
Okay, so as I was said, this is an auspicious time for the company. We just received a 510K for the GenStrip to market it. We are in the process of putting our distribution together and realigning our organization to take advantage of this opportunity. We now have the ability to market it in the United States. We continue on a number of fronts to build the company. That's pretty much what I have to say at this particular point.
What do you mean? Dick Wessner.
Yes.
Hey, Dick, hi. How are you? It's Keith.
Look, Keith, how are you doing?
Good, thanks. And I'm Keith Berman, and I'll reiterate what Bob said. I haven't had an opportunity to sleep since all of the days, 20-hour days we put into getting the FDA approval completed. But I would assume that most of the people that are on this call because they wish to know more about that approval and what we plan to do. And what I would like to do is open up the floor for questioning.
We'll do the 15th call for $2.
Could we please keep the background chatter down? Okay. Because the conference room picks up everything that you're saying. So in any event, we're going to open this up for questioning, and we'll go as long as the people on this call wish us to go. So who has the first question?
Keith, I wanted to ask you a question about about LifeScan. In other words, the strip's all right, and now they're saying about the device, about putting the strip in the device. Did you get that? Can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can.
Yeah.
Bob, why don't you address that question?
I'm not sure what the question is. Do you put the strip? What we have a 510K clearance for?
In other words, I looked at that light scan, that quart tube or whatever it is, and the strip's all right now. Now they're saying about using the strip in the meter, in their meter.
Yeah.
I was just wondering. In other words, how does that look as far as what you're trying to say?
Well, first of all, we're a alternative to the existing J&J diagnostic strip that goes into their devices. That is the size of the opportunity. There are 6.5 million of those devices out there, and we have been FDA cleared to use our strip with those devices. So we're taking advantage of a customer base that J&J has control, but they can't keep. But we're allowed to use our strip in the device according to the FDA, based upon clinical results that we supplied to the FDA by testing our strip in their devices.
Okay, well, that's what I wanted to know. I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
How are you going to get to these people? Through the drugstores or direct mailing?
I'll take that. We have three models. There's a retail model, which is for chain drugstores, large mega stores, department stores, That's one model. Yeah, like Walmart and Costco and the chain grocery stores like Kroger. Those stores that are centrally managed, chain drug stores are centrally managed, where the decision to carry the strip can be made by a central management team that would decide. That way, we won't have to call on each individual drugstore. That's one business model. A second business model, which in the past would have been called a wholesale business model, would be to go to large regional distributors who have a book of business that sell to independent drugstores, mom-and-pop drugstores, but to some degree those chain stores that are not centrally managed, and they will distribute directly to that group of people. The third...
Roger Burns.
Say that again, I'm sorry. Okay, it must have been somebody signing it. The third business is the mail order business, which we can talk about in a little bit. That's a business that is a bit in flux right now, not having anything to do with GenStrip, but having to do with Medicare. So we're probably not going to go into that gung-ho with both feet for a while, but we're going to concentrate on an offshoot of that business called the DME business, the durable medical equipment business, where large DMEs, these are catalog medical supplies companies, do sell products directly to small distributors and as well as individual patients. And basically, those are our three business models. The largest one, the easiest one to achieve, is the retail model.
Why has the press release not been issued?
We'll issue a press release when the company's entire business plan is put together, which the 510K by itself is not believed to be newsworthy. It's probably a seminal event in the company, but we can't tie any statements to it. It's just an event that's occurred, so we posted it on our website. But as soon as we sign the financing agreement and are ready to announce first deliveries, we're going to have a whole series of announcements to make.
You don't think getting FDA approval is newsworthy or important to the company?
It's probably material to people who trade stock, but it's not material to the company's business at the moment. I mean, it's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful accomplishment, but unless we can say in the press release something other than we received FDA approval, which is publicly available information in many places, we'll end up diluting our message and not being able to say the right thing to the marketplace.
What's the target time frame for sales and distribution?
We hope to make some deliveries this year, but we'll hit the ground running beginning January 1, 2013.
Do you have any specific orders?
Say that again?
Do you have any specific orders from the either Walmart or Costco or any drugstores?
I can't comment on that. The answer to that is yes, but I can't go into specifics. We do have substantial orders.
How about financing are you?
I said that we do have orders in. We have a distribution contract with Walmart. One of the reasons this conference call is so late today is that we had a conference call with them earlier this morning, and that will be part of its own news release within the next few days. We do have substantial orders in-house from large regional distributors, not a single one of those businesses less than $100 million a year in revenue by themselves. And those orders in-house will make up 100% of our deliverable product for the next 90 days.
From the inventory?
from the manufacturer's from inventory, yes, but also from the manufacturer's capability to manufacture products.
Is your package going to be looking the same for everybody, or is it going to be different?
There will be two packages. And then there will be
The size going to be 50 and 100, or different sizes?
There'll be 50s only to start. Actually, the 100s... I interrupted somebody.
If you touch base on your business model, is there a potential for another business model of the home healthcare market, such as getting a master distribution agreement with a Amedisys or somebody of that nature, or would that fall into your wholesale business model?
Yeah, that would fall into the wholesale business model. By the way, the wholesale business model has two parts to it. It's kind of a complex market because of Medicare and the ever-shifting sands of Medicare. Every market changes virtually every year. The wholesale market right now is made up of large regional distributors that sell to small independent drugstores, small other independent distributors, clinics, and the like. The second half of that are what are known as GPOs, which are group purchasing organizations. There are about three or four of them that really matter, and basically you buy catalog space only for them these days. Catalog space means an online catalog. We've been a med assets provider for years. They're the largest in that field, so they will fall under the wholesale model as well.
Who is that?
And they will carry your product?
Yes.
Is a margin
and then, and then there are also in that GPO, there are large companies that do not specialize in our business, in the strip business, but offer, for example, they service nursing homes. And
to
give you an example, Medline falls into that category. And we'll have an agreement with Medline.
And obviously they're going to receive the product at a bulk rate, at a discount, but at the same time, you're looking at volume versus outside box per box sales.
Volume discount is how the marketplace works.
Correct.
But the difference between a customer that buys 1,000 a month and a customer that buys 500,000 a month, if we're ever so lucky, is minimal difference. The big when you get to about 25,000 a month, that's when the big price break occurs. But just to give you an idea, the customer that pays $20 at 1,000 a month and the customer that pays $1,750 at 500,000 a month are basically that same customer. That's unfortunate, but we're not a big enough company at the present time to change that mindset. And that type of mindset was ingrained into the distribution marketplace by LifeScan and Bayer and Roche years and years ago. And that's what these people understand.
Do you have limited capacity to manufacture or not?
No. We have unlimited ability to manufacture, but certain of the raw materials have large lead times. Large lead time meaning 30 days. For example, and I think we've said this in the past, Leon, but we've had we've said that December is a horrible month for a number of reasons to launch a product.
Yeah.
But the biggest reason that it's a horrible month is that one of the raw components, a chemical that is used for the product called the Mediator, is a product manufactured by Dow Chemical Company. And Dow is basically closed this month. So we bought all we could of this chemical on the gray market, and that's why we'll be able to deliver some strips during the month of December. But there will be a carryover into January until real quantity of the raw components can be delivered. And, of course, those chemicals degrade with time. They have shelf life of their own. So nobody wants to, with the FDA being the way they were, nobody wants to make a substantial purchase of raw materials and have that have to be thrown away. So that's what we're looking at.
Is the raw material has a life, or the end product has also life?
Both. The end product.
Now what is the life on the end product?
The useful life of the end product will be delivered immediately with 18 months.
So 18 months is the life of the strip?
Yes.
Okay. Can you tell us approximately, and I know it's a very difficult number right now, what do you think revenue of the company for 2013 going to be?
13?
Yeah.
Well, we forecast that, but that will probably put guidance out in January, as we've done in the past. But there's no reason to believe that revenue guidance for our first year of shipment won't be any different than what we have that we've guided in the past.
What was the number? I don't remember.
I don't recall either, but it was, compared to where we've been before, it was a substantial number, a large number.
Where can we look at the number? It's in the filings?
No, it should be on our website.
It would be by analyst. Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Is any analyst going to pick up the coverage?
We certainly hope so.
Do you have anybody in mind? You're talking to anybody or just maybe?
As a matter of fact, I gave an interview yesterday, and I have another interview to give later this afternoon. And we'll get coverage from a real analyst here very shortly. I also talk on a weekly basis with the Boston Consulting Group. And, of course, they're the preeminent analysts of the biomedical marketplace. And believe it or not, they actually found out about our FDA approval several days before we found out about our FDA approval. So they're pretty much tied into the market, and they'll of course cover us because they cover all the major strip manufacturers.
So, can I ask you a question? How many shares outstanding, fully diluted, we have right now?
11,500,000 outstanding. Another 2.5 million that are underlie preferred stock. Virtually all of those shares are. A default collateral for our credit line.
So it's basically 14 million shares, 20 cents. It's like $2.8 million value of the company.
Yes.
Yeah. Keith, it's Steve Holland. How are you?
Hi, Steve.
Hi, I have one question. I know on your website you posted this prior, and now that you have the approval, have you hired or located the team that's going to roll out the sales for your product?
That's going to roll out what? I'm sorry.
The sales of GenStrip. Sales and marketing.
We have, you know, the company's been involved in this business for about 5 years, and. We have 8 or 9 distributors, local distributors, regional distributors throughout the country. And these people are going to be the first rollout customers. Every one of these has anywhere from between 1,200 to 2,500 individual drugstores, clinics, and the like that they'll draw on. And then, of course, there's Walmart, and hopefully, before the year is over, we hope to announce an agreement with at least one other large retailer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Are you able to go forward with your business without financing? And do you have any idea when this financing may come in?
The company can go ahead without large financing, but it would mean that we would have to put terms on our sales that are not industry standard, which of course will lower the level of sales.
Do you have financing lined up, or is that imminent? Is it close?
It will close before December 31st.
Okay.
Congratulations for your achievement. You did a great job.
Well, I mean, you know, Bob, you used to manage this area at another company. You might want to talk about what a remarkable achievement it has been.
Yeah, I look at it from different points of view. I actually managed. I was the vice president of strategic marketing, and I also had regulatory reported to me at a company called LaserScope that was a NASDAQ traded stock, got acquired by a couple companies since then. And I had a 8-member team, and actually back then we were able to get almost 25 10-Ks during that time. It was never easy. We had to do a lot of work. We had to do the clinical trials. It was in a different area. It wasn't in vitro diagnostics. Real up to today, I've been involved with some other startups in the medical device area, and I know, like in Silicon Valley, where I live right now, there are venture capitalists that are more or less pulling out of the medical device field, I've been told, since 2007, just because of their concern with getting to the FDA. I think it is given, you know, and there's been a lot of articles published on this, at how difficult, how intransient the FDA is on getting 510Ks. I can tell you as a board member and the other board member, I don't know if Bill showed up yet, but we, having had experience since that time in 510Ks and hearing all the stories, know that the FDA has gotten extremely hard to deal with. And that has, in large part, accounted for why it took almost 2 years to get through this process. To achieve this is just amazing. The FDA was putting up almost all their usual resistance to any kind of 510Ks. The attitude in the FDA seems to be very anti-business. And so to achieve this was a monumental task.
75-76 calls a year out and 2 years out on aging.
Hello.
Incidentally, Keith, I am on the call. This is Bill Lyon.
Hi, Bill.
Hi, guys. I've been here, but I've been very quiet. For anyone that's on the call, I am also on the board of directors, and I certainly would like to also commend Keith for what he's been able to do. I am a president of a medical device company. I know the level of complexity and difficulty that he has overcome in securing his 510K market clearance. In fact, I have told Keith in the past, as I've told the board of directors, that I thought it was highly unlikely that he would be able to achieve this. When I learned of this, the first thing I did was call Keith and admitted that I was wrong and he was absolutely right. He has pulled off what I consider to be a absolutely remarkable achievement, and he should be applauded for having done so. That's really all I would like to say.
Yep, I second that.
Thanks for the compliments, Bill and Bob. But I will, just so you people that are on this call understand, our record, and then I'll go into a little history of the whole process, because some people may be interested in it, having never been through it. Our record, the paper record that we filed with the FDA that began after the application was filed, but when they first acknowledged receiving the file, even before DECN was became contractually obligated to manage the process, our paper record is 8 feet tall. That's how much exchange we've had with the FDA. Now, a lot of it is repeating the things we repeated previously and repeated before that. But just to give you an idea, we had 17 rounds of comments. We asked for 7 extensions and did not receive the breakthrough from the FDA until June of this year. It was, and by the way, as badly as we feel that we were treated and as hard as it was for us to overcome this, the lawyer that we hired to represent us that does this for a living tells me we were one of the easy ones. That there are companies that have spent $70 million trying to get these approvals and still haven't gotten the approvals. There are biotech diagnostic firms that have spent that amount of money. Most of it venture startup money. There's some Amex traded biotechs that are trying to get this approved. But because diagnostics are treated as medical devices, the entire medical device industry is under attack for some reason. One of the other things that I don't think many of you know. Do you know there's a special tax on medical devices that was levied as part of the fiscal stimulus in 2009, and then it became part of Obamacare? There is no other industry anywhere that has a special tax unless it's a sin type of product.
How do you explain that?
Somebody decided, and, you know, I guess that will be a nameless, faceless person, but somebody decided that taxing medical devices, taxing better health, was a good thing to do.
And this was in 2011?
Yes. Yeah, it was, no, 2010. It was the Obamacare that memorialized it. And that tax begins January 1, 2012. Bill.
Taxing is the most productive entity in the country becomes.
Yeah. So, you know, this is a remarkable achievement.
Yes.
How you doing, sir, Keith?
Yeah.
This is Mr. Gibson. I have been a long-term shareholder and went through some trials and the split with the stock. Is the financing going to be dilutive to the current long-term shareholders?
It will be dilutive because you have ongoing fees, but it's not. You know, a lot of people in our marketplace equate financing with things like equity lines and things of that nature. That's not the case here. Us guys as a board in 2010, right before the 2010 shareholder conference call, we all decided collectively that we weren't going to do any of those types of financing. Frankly, Bob Jagenich and I fought for 5 years against that type of financing that prior management had gotten the company involved in. And we would still be saddled with that financing if the company that previous management entered into an agreement to hadn't filed for bankruptcy, which we were able to settle and get out of that bad deal. But by the way, we're shareholders just like all of you guys are. So
yes.
If we're going to dilute the company, and there are substantial numbers of small public companies, bulletin board companies, and pink sheet companies that enter into these kind of financings for a couple of reasons, but the most important reason is so that management can continue earning large salaries, because it is a way to monetize the company's stock. We've never viewed it that way. We've always viewed that our job is to provide the best product and the best company available that we possibly can. And our belief has been as shareholders, and I've been a shareholder in this company since 1999, Bob Jagenich as well. I think Bill Lyons has been a shareholder since 2001 or 2002. Our goal has always been to make the value of the company as high as possible and to keep it growing, because if the shareholders benefit, we as shareholders benefit also.
Are there any updates to the Johnson & Johnson lawsuit?
In terms of what?
Just that. Any updates? Any change?
There have been a few changes in the last couple of days that I can't speak about yet, but you will find it online when certain papers are filed with the court. I can say this, because this is publicly available information, that as part of the Johnson & Johnson lawsuit, the legal firm that represents Pharmatech and Decision Diagnostics filed a challenge to Johnson & Johnson's patents. And typically those challenges go unreviewed, because a lot of times they're shots in the dark. Our guys filed these challenges. All three of those challenges were granted last Friday, and there was already a cursory review of those three patents, and Johnson & Johnson was slapped a bit by the reviewer, a special reviewer that's overlooking these patents.
Do you have decision points?
And we're going to ask our lawyers in the next couple of days if we can't post these patent review requests, which are public information, on our website. In terms of the lawsuit itself, these are kind of long-range affairs, but if the patents are thrown out, the lawsuit's gone too.
May I ask you a question? Is Johnson & Johnson had their product after you have their product? How come there is an infringement possibility?
We can't find any infringement possibility. That's one of the issues that we're dealing with here. In the generic drug business, typically the generic drug manufacturers manufacture exact copies of an existing brand name drug where the patent has run out. And sometimes they get in litigation, sometimes they don't, but that's a very tried and true path. This particular product is not a generic product. It's an alternative product. And as a result of that, of it being a generic product, it was independently developed and independently designed and independently tested. And whereas it works on a Johnson & Johnson meter, because that's what it was designed to do, it doesn't infringe on the, at least that's our opinion and our lawyer's opinion, and we think it's going to be the Patent and Trademark Office opinion as well. It doesn't infringe on any of the... Go ahead, Bob.
I just want to make clear, as you all know, courts and regulatory bodies make their own decisions, and although we feel strongly that we don't infringe, there is always the possibility, and there's always that caveat.
But again, if the Patent and Trademark Office finds that Johnson & Johnson's patent is not an effective patent, the patents go away and the lawsuit goes away.
Keith?
Yes?
This is Roger from Chicago.
Hi.
I was wondering, how you doing?
Good, Roger. How are you? Did you get snow?
All right. Pardon?
Yeah. Did you get a lot of snow?
Nah, not yet. We set a record. No snow yet. I want to say congratulations on the 510, and I was wondering about the, are you going to promote this? There was some talk about a, what was it, last year, about a info commercial. I don't know what became of that, but what's the marketing plan?
We have, we're in discussions at the moment and are ready to sign an agreement with an LA-based firm that is going to produce a 60-second commercial, and a 4-minute infomercial for the company, all at one price, which we'll probably post one of the two commercials plus the infomercial on YouTube. And once that happens, all of these shows that book space on Lifetime and TLC and so on will probably want to have us interviewed for their morning shows, primarily addressed to women, plus the diabetes networks that broadcast into diabetic doctors' office. Diabetic doctors' treatment offices will want to pick that up as well. Those of you who have looked, we're on Facebook already, so we'll probably have these infomercials on Facebook and posted on Facebook and on our website.
And YouTube.
Keith, I have a question for you. This is Michael Dion. First of all, congratulations.
Hi, Mike.
That's awesome. Awesome news. Great job. I wanted to ask, you sort of touched on some financing that was looking like you might announce it by year end. Will this financing take care of all your needs long term and short term, or is it something that might just handle short term and you'll have to go back to the market? Will this solve the one thing that everybody would love to know, which is we are done with our financing?
Well, we can understand how people that trade stocks for a living and look at dilution would be interested in that. But frankly, if we were to go to the market and raise money for our financing at today's price levels, we would be doing everybody a disservice. So the
Absolutely.
Goal now is, certainly Bill and Bob and I were involved with another company a decade ago that caught the wind at that particular point in time, and their stock went from like 17 cents to $9, and you know they were smart enough to raise money in chunks. They weren't smart enough to keep us around, but they did their financings correctly, and they waited for appropriate levels and typically raised the same amount of money, but each time they went to the market to raise that money, they offered fewer and fewer shares to raise that money. And that's kind of our goal, too. The financing that we're doing to finance the sales of the product is very different. That's credit financing. That's a kind of a traditional way that companies operate. The other financing we're looking to do is about $1 million of equity capital. Hopefully we pick up a partner as a result of that. It certainly won't be an equity line. It won't be anything that that is toxic. It won't be anything that is a death spiral or any of those type of things. And it will only be with a fund or people that specialize in these things, or a consortium of people. For example, I have a conference call scheduled for tomorrow with a group of doctors that may consider investing. So, companies like us will always have to go. If we're growing and we're going to be, I'm just going to pull a number out of the air. Let's say we're going to be a $30 million company without putting a time period on that $30 million. The financing needs for a $30 million company are certainly different than the financing needs for a $500 million company.
Thank you. And why dilute the company and the shareholders if you do all the financing now? Understood. Thank you.
There's also on the financing in terms of profitability right now, because our current model in going to bank-like institutions is based upon our old business, in which it was difficult to get good terms. As our model, as our business grows and our model proves out, we will also be getting better terms. So we don't want to sign up with a long-term organization that we can't get out of to get better financing rates and that type of thing. So profitability will also improve as we go up.
Is any plans for other testing hardware to do now, or you want to postpone until you have cash flow from the Johnson & Johnson strips?
Actually, Leon, that's a very good question. In addition to the
before
finance...
that was a bad question.
No, it's a good question. In addition to raising the money to finance the sales of GenStrip and then $1 million or so of working capital that the company needs, we're also going to raise money and establish an R&D partnership. And, yes, it is the company's plan, because we've broken the code and we know how to get FDA approval. Not that it'll be, you know, a quick, like if LiveScan filed for a 510K, they'd be approved in less than 30 days. We don't hope to do that, but we do hope that it's faster than 2.5 years from inception. But we're looking at two models that we wish to follow for the next diagnostic strip that we're going to come out with. The first model that we're looking at is a model for a strip that we can leverage some of the experience gained on the LiveScan, doing the LiveScan strip, the Ultra alternative strip. We wish to leverage that experience and do one that is of a similar nature, but probably one generation newer. That's probably something we can do rather quickly, quickly in those terms, not quickly in daily terms. You know, we could probably do that in 9 to 12 months. But the market for that strip is somewhat smaller. Or we could take on a project where the market is much larger, but the strip to do is much more complicated.
Bayer's?
Well, I don't want to get into discussing other companies' names. The company's already been sued once prior to launching a product, just because some people that used to be close to the company called that other company and got them interested in things that hadn't happened yet. So let's just kind of keep that to a minimum. I will tell you this, four companies, until we came along, four companies make up 92% of the total market in diabetic test strips.
Can you give us a from the highest to lowest, like Johnson & Johnson 1, 2, 3, and 4?
Well, we need to look at this worldwide, because ultimately, if we don't come up with an international version of this product, the U.S. distributors are going to try to divert the goods overseas, because it always happens. So we look at the market worldwide, and this is a market that's always growing. Used to be that the growth in the U.S. Was probably 2 to 3 times higher than the growth in the rest of the world, but now it's turned, and it's just the opposite. The growth in the U.S. is 5 to 7 to 10% a year, and the growth overseas is in the 20% area. If you look overseas, Roche, Hoffmann-La Roche, and Johnson & Johnson LiveScan are 1 and 2 or 2 and 1, any way you look at it. And each of them are in the vicinity of mid to upper 30% mark. It's a different kind of market over here, slightly different market. The other two major players are Abbott Diagnostics, another U.S. company, and at Bayer Healthcare, which is a German company. And they're number three and number four. And collectively, those four account for about 90% of the market. There are about 100 other players, mostly Chinese companies, Chinese, Taiwanese, and Korean companies that have launched products to marginal success. The largest of that group of companies is like 0.8%. And the reason that they haven't been as successful are successful at all, other than the fact that they're foreign products and there are large groups of Americans that just won't buy a non-American medical product. But one of the reasons that these companies haven't been successful is that they got a late start on the market. They didn't come to market until 2007, maybe 2006 they got their FDA approval. And by then there were already 7 million users of diabetic meters on the market at that point, all of them, virtually all of them, from the large four pharmaceutical companies. And they've proven to everybody that it's very, very difficult to sell a new meter and strip combination to a type 2 diabetic that average is 67 years of age, is usually male, and a large percentage of them are institutionalized. Very expensive, very hard to change their meter configuration, which is why going in the alternative strip route has proven so successful for us, or at least on the verge of success.
I was in Eastern Europe about a month ago, and I was in two countries, and I went specifically in the drugstores to see what kind of strips they sell. They all sell American strips.
Yeah.
No, American. They all sell the same strip what you mentioned, the names.
Yeah, but there'll be a different language on the box.
That's right. But this is exactly the same. And in Europe, do you need the same approval or much easier approval for the strips?
Much easier approval. The process is called CE marking in the European community. Used to be, and this was until about a year and a half ago, you didn't need FDA approval to sell products overseas. For example, Johnson & Johnson sells a product here called Vario. They sold that product in Europe for 2 years before they received FDA approval on it over here. They changed that, I want to say, in October of 2010, or it might have been February of 2011. They changed the procedure there, where to get your CE mark, you have to prove that you have some sort of regulatory oversight approval on the product. However, and I guess I haven't answered your question, Leon, the CE process is typically a 6-week process.
Oh, it's nothing. It's not a 7-foot of paper.
I'm sorry, somebody else ask a question?
Oh, yes, sir. As the company, that's another milestone that we'd be looking forward to accomplishing? Overseas approval?
That's a late first quarter 2013 project.
Thank you.
Chief, this is Darren Bankston. You mentioned that the four major manufacturers supply 90% of the market. What would you consider twofold is what is a successful market penetration, and then what would be, let's just say, beyond your wildest dream market penetration?
Well, you know, Darren, I spend a lot of my time dealing with people that are in the marketplace. And one of the things that we pretty much discovered is that we're going to be able to take advantage of all of these Chinese and Korean products that are, which collectively are known as value strips. They're strips that typically okay. sell for less than $10 a vial to people who actually buy these things. But our belief is that we could probably grow this product over a period of 5 years to the point where we're about 10% of the market, of the market for Johnson & Johnson products. I think if we screwed everything up, and by screwing everything up, I mean we aren't able to raise capital, our marketing plan is wrong, our pricing structure is way off base, we'll still probably achieve 2 or 3%.
And out of that 92% Johnson & Johnson controls?
In the high, depending upon the markets that you wish to include in this, like, for example, if you picked up a market research study.
In general number.
Well, there is no such thing, and that's what I was just trying to get to. The office, there's a company in Philadelphia called IMS, and IMS is the industry's reporter of what is sold by what companies. Actually, manufacturers report to IMS online and tell them which markets by SIC code they sell into. And by and large, it's difficult to get numbers from the mail order end of the market. So when you're looking at an IMS survey, that survey may show you that Johnson & Johnson LifeScan may control in the mid-40s in terms of market share, but very few of these companies are able to convert the mail order market, which is direct-to-patient market, into the overall market share, and that isn't LifeScan's forte market anyway. They're not hugely successful in that market, for example. Well, just to make this easier, my guess is that Bayer, which is a force in the mail order market, underreports, and Ultra LifeScan overreports because of the way that the boxes are counted, which is a huge emphasis on the retail pharmacy market. We are not forecasting at the moment because of Medicare competitive bidding, which has kind of turned the entire market into a flux. We have not forecast the mail order market. So when I tell you okay. if we screw up 2 or 3%, and if we do great 10%, that doesn't include mail order.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Any additional questions?
No. Who distributes to my house?
Who distributes to his house?
Who distributes to whose house?
The CVS company, which is one of the largest distributors. Do you involve them? Because they are one of the people who started this stuff.
Somebody's got a bad line. I can't hear who's speaking.
I will call you separately and ask you.
All right, that's fine.
Can you hear me, Keith? Roger?
Yeah, I sure can, Roger.
At what point do you think we will be getting off the OTCVB?
Um, there are several requirements that the company needs to achieve to move on to the Amex or the NASDAQ market. In addition to having the registration fee, which is substantial, but the two areas that we don't currently meet where compromises with the exchanges probably wouldn't be to the company's liking, the director's liking at the moment, are the stock price. They would demand a reverse split, and they would demand a very draconian reverse split so that we got well into the $3 range, $3.50 range for the stock, which we think the stock will go to anyway over a period of time. And the other criteria we don't meet, we will meet the moment we raise $1 million of working capital.
All right. Thank you.
Keith, can you just go through quickly the cost of the product and what you're selling the product for, and then comparing that to what Johnson & Johnson is selling their strips for?
Well, I won't go into the cost of the product because it will involve discussing fees, royalties that we have to pay and commissions that we have to pay. By the way, guys, one of the benefits of this is that we were approached by a company that had the sales rights to this product who sold us the sales rights under the condition that we also took over the regulatory process, among other things, or else it wouldn't be a GenStrip today. So I won't go into the costing of it other than to say that the margins that we're going to achieve even after tax are nearly big pharma margins. So it's going to be a markedly successful product.
Even gross margin or net margin?
Profit before tax.
Okay.
And then of course we have a lot of tax loss carry forwards, but. It's going to be a big-time pharma-like product for probably most of its life cycle. In terms of the selling price...
Keith, I would counsel not raising selling price as an issue right now.
Say that again?
I would not recommend that you discuss selling price right now.
Well, the question was
up to you, but I would recommend that you do not.
Yeah, actually, I wasn't going to. I wasn't going to answer that. What I was going to say was,
forget I said anything then.
Say that again.
I said forget I said anything then.
I don't even know who asked the question.
It's Bill.
Oh, hi, Bill.
Hi, Keith. I didn't ask the question. I commented on not commenting on the price. Someone asked you a question, I don't know who it was, about what your anticipated sell price is versus J&J.
I'll give general broad outlines. The J&J retail box, they just had a price increase in 2012 and in 11 and in 10 and in 9. It sells for about $1.25 a strip. And in 2010, they broke the dollar... a strip level, which was a psychological level that changed the market, and of course everybody followed suit. And our goal is to provide a product that costs substantially less than that, because our value proposition is totally based on selling a strip for less than the competition. Now, as an aside, our strip also works better, but and Bob, you might want to talk about that too. But there is a major value proposition to this strip versus the Johnson & Johnson strip.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that J&J has a fairly large percentage.
percentage of the market. It's one of the two major leaders of the oligopoly. And that our strip is better, which in dealing with certain marketing agreements that we will achieve is an advantage because I think that these retailers or marketers for us will are looking for a price concession because of J&J's dominance. You know, and there is an oligopoly is exactly what it is. J&J sets the pricing, I think, for the industry. We will come in substantially less than that. I think the advantage of it ultimately is the consumer, because even though Medicare pay, and, you know, when Keith talks about the average consumer is around 67 and male, you're looking at somebody that's on Medicare where they only pay $31 per strip. So a lot of that is coming out of people's pocket. And we want to appeal to that, as well as J&J has provide rather thin margins to the distributors, so there's going to be some workout between the price that we charge and what they will charge consumers, but it's going to benefit consumers as well as the distribution channels we will be approaching. And, you know, we have to work out something where we get fair margins. At the same time, we take advantage of our lower cost structure to underprice J&J and benefit the whole distribution chain as well as the consumer. It will have a strong message, I think, in the overall market. Okay. Can anybody hear me?
Any further questions?
When do you think the first batch of product will hit the department, the drug stores?
We are negotiating that with the manufacturer this week. We have a conference call on Friday where they're supposed to report back to us. It's kind of a high-class problem that we face. Our belief was that we were probably going to get our approval in 2012, but it would be like the last day of business in 2012 for the FDA, where us and a whole bunch of other companies that were after them for approvals that had waited a long, long period of time for these approvals. And the FDA was kind of like out of questions, out of ammunition to shoot them down. We actually thought that we would get our approval on the 21st of December, and it came 3 weeks earlier than that. As a result of that, the manufacturer decided that they were going to do what all the manufacturers in this industry do. They were going to close down for the week from before Christmas until the end of the year. So what they're going to tell us when we meet with them on the phone on Friday, is how much they can produce this year, given their shutdown, and they'll end up actually boxing the product and adding the package insert at their facility, as opposed to what a lot of companies do, which is they manufacture the product and then they send it out to a packaging company. So there will be product delivered this year. We'll get it to our distributors this year, and it will probably reach drugstores first or second week of January.
Delicate question. Will Johnson & Johnson press the drugstores or anyone who has a shelf space against your product?
Well, as you know, shelf space is always a big deal in the retail market.
Yes, I do. That's a mess.
However, and this is a very interesting chain of events that have occurred. And by the way, shelf space is one of the reasons why the Chinese and the Korean products haven't been a big success in the U.S. because, you know, they're relegated to lesser shelf space and lesser trafficked areas in the drugstores. However, the number five company, when there used to be the big five, there was a company called Home Diagnostics. It was a NASDAQ-traded company. They had an interesting product mix. Their specialty, I guess everybody has specialties. Their specialty was selling private label products to companies like Invacare, that is a major DME distributor of product, and Walmart, for example, that used to use the HDI product for their own brand name, which is called RelyOn. HDI sold the company a bit under duress. They were having a few problems with the Securities and Exchange Commission. They sold the company in 2010, a bit under duress, to the Japanese company Nipro. And HDI at one time had a 4% market share, when the Big Five owned 98% of the market. And the Nipro group does not have, plus their products are beginning to age as well. The Nipro group does not command the shelf space in drugstores that they used to. So we kind of believe that we'll be able to jump in there and be able to pick up some shelf space that we wouldn't otherwise be able to pick up, because we're going to be a big moneymaker for drugstores, which is also part of the value proposition. Not only will we make great money, but the people that carry our product will make better money.
What you're telling me is that the margins for the retailer, your margins are going to be higher than Johnson & Johnson margins.
Yes.
Yes.
They'll be able to
undercut JJ's price as well.
Yeah. The price will be less, and the margins for the drugstore will be higher, simply because the oligopoly, the group of four companies, has priced themselves to the point where it's virtually impossible for a retailer to mark up the test strip products by 30% on a retail level, which is the margins that independent drugstores look to achieve. They just can't do that. But they will be able to mark our product up 30% and make great money on it.
Okay. Thank you very much. Very, very good conference call.
Any additional questions? Okay, well, I thank everybody for attending. We'll probably try to do one of these in a couple of months where we can actually report some GenStrip progress and things of that nature. So, with that, I guess we'll all sign off, and the conference call company will breathe a sigh of relief.